Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the pioneers of forensic science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We will talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people wielding it, failed. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of The Science of Murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. In my daily life, I'm a medical laboratory scientist. My profession is grounded in the how and why of biological and chemical data. I'm someone who looks at a clinical result and tries to see the human story behind the numbers. That's kind of how I look at these cases. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen and how science has developed to catch and convict the offenders. I'm here to open these conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one out here fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want us to find each other and learn together. Today we are discussing the science of the University of Tennessee Anthropological Research Facility, also known as the Body Farm. In our previous episode, we looked at how entertainment and fiction, like Patricia Cornwell's novel The Body Farm, featuring Kay Scarpetta, or television shows like Bones, frequently utilize human decomposition facilities as spooky, atmospheric plot points. Forget the Hollywood aesthetic. Today we are stepping into clinical reality. We are looking at the actual facility founded by Dr. William Bass in 1981, the world's first outdoor tephonomic laboratory. It isn't a horror movie. It's a high-stakes calibration facility operating under strict research protocols, specifically designed to turn the chaotic, messy variables of nature into a standardized mathematical baseline. It all started in December of 1977, when Dr. William Bass was called out to a disturbed historic cemetery in Franklin, Tennessee. Grave robbers had targeted the burial site of a prominent Civil War family, and local authorities discovered a headless male body sitting atop a disturbed cast iron coffin. Because the remains were found on top of the historical vault rather than inside it, the immediate assumption was that a modern killer had used the old cemetery to dump a recent victim. When Dr. Bass conducted his initial macro assessment of the tissue, the data seemed to point squarely toward a fresh homicide. The flesh was still pink, intact, and holding moisture. The muscles retained structural integrity, and there was a distinct lack of advanced putrefaction or insect activity. Based on the state of the soft tissue, Dr. Bass estimated that this individual had been dead for maybe a few weeks, a year at the absolute maximum. Acting on this expert forensic baseline, the local police immediately launched a full-scale homicide investigation, looking for a modern perpetrator. He was off by over a century. A subsequent exhaustive audit of the historical archives, genealogy records, and clothing artifacts quickly proved that the body belonged to Colonel William Shy, a Confederate officer who was shot in the head at the Battle of Nashville in December of 1864. The massive error wasn't due to sloppy observation. It was due to an unprecedented environmental variable. Colonel Shai had been buried in a Fisk metallic burial case, a specialized cast iron coffin that was completely airtight and securely sealed. This high integrity seal created a sterile anaerobic preservation chamber. It essentially pickled the soft tissue, completely halting the normal biochemical clock of decomposition. When the grave robbers breached that cast iron seal in 1977, they exposed a 113-year-old biological record that looked like it belonged to a current case file because the environment had frozen the data in time. This wasn't a failure of intelligence, it was a total failure of reference material. This professional deep clean moment forced Dr. Bass to admit an uncomfortable reality. The forensic textbooks of the era were based on pure guesswork and anecdotal data. Forensic science had absolutely no calibrated human baseline for how a body breaks down across different environments in the real world. Boss didn't just accept the error and move on. He went directly to the administration at the University of Tennessee, pitched the use of a small patch of woods and an old sow barn, and established the world's first outdoor decomposition lab. His argument to the university was simple and definitive. We cannot function as accurate investigators if we do not possess a controlled, scientifically validated environment to study and calculate the postmortem interval. To truly understand why Dr. William Bass had to build an outdoor laboratory from scratch in 1981, we have to look at the deeply fractured black market history of anatomical science. For centuries, medicine and early forensics operated under a cloud of systemic friction and desperate compromise. If a physician, an early pathologist, or a legal investigator wanted to understand human anatomy, trauma, or the postmortem timeline, there were no textbooks with calibrated data. The laws of the land strictly prohibited the dissection of human bodies, with rare exceptions made for executed criminals. This artificial restriction created a massive data starvation on the clinical bench. To fill that gap, the scientific community had to look to the shadows. They relied on resurrection men, professional grave robbers who operated in the dead of night, targeting fresh cemetery plots, digging up the recently deceased, and packing them into crates to sell out the back door of elite medical schools. It was a lucrative, highly illegal industry, driven entirely by science's desperate need for reference material. By the early 19th century, this black market spiraled into a full-blown corporate horror story. In Edinburgh, Scotland, two men named William Burke and William Hare realized that graveyard excavation was a bit too much manual labor. They decided to optimize the supply chain. Instead of digging up the dead, they began luring vulnerable, transient lodging house guests to their quarters, getting them intoxicated, and suffocating them away that left no external marks of trauma. They sold the pristine, fresh bodies directly to Dr. Robert Knox's anatomy lectures for top dollar. This method of murder became structurally known as Birking. It was an unregulated, non-scientific, and deeply unethical nightmare. It meant that the foundational knowledge of human anatomy was quite literally bought with blood, leaving early forensic pathology with a legacy of stolen, uncalibrated data points. Fast forward to the mid to late 20th century. The ethical landscape had rightfully evolved, and grave robbing was a relic of the past, but it left modern forensic scientists facing the exact same old problem: a severe lack of human data. Before Dr. Bass secured the legal and administrative clearance to utilize human cadavers for decomposition research at the University of Tennessee, forensic scientists were trapped in a major limitation loop. To conduct any sort of controlled experiment on how a body decays, they had to rely entirely on swine proxies. Even if you watch current media today, shows like CSI, Criminal Minds, or Bones, you'll constantly see television investigators shooting pigs with different calibers, burying them under porches, or dropping them into swamps to reconstruct a timeline for a court case. Hollywood treats the pig proxy as an absolute flawless substitute for a human victim. But out here in the real world, inside an actual laboratory, we know that animal proxies are simply an incomplete ledger. While domestic pigs are a decent biological analog for things like skin thickness, general torso size, and body fat ratios, they ultimately fail under close scientific auditing. Swine possess a completely different bone density and structural architecture than a bipedal human being. They have different dental configurations, which ruins bite mark or oral degradation tracking. Most importantly, their internal microbiome and the specific fat distribution profiles do not match our own. When a human body breaks down, the bacterial flora in our gut, the very engine of putrefaction, unleashes a highly specific chemical off-gassing profile. A pig decaying in a field releases a completely different array of volatile organic compounds. If you're trying to train a cadaver dog to find a hidden human grave, or if you're running a gas chromatography mass spectrometry audit to detect the exact chemical signature of a clandestine burial site, a pig proxy will give you flawed metrics. You cannot calibrate a human justice system using animal data. Dr. Bass recognized this systemic flaw. He knew that if forensic science was going to stand up in a modern courtroom, it needed real human parameters. In 1981, he successfully petitioned the University of Tennessee to clear a secure 1.5 acre patch of woods located right behind the University Medical Center. He surrounded it with a heavy chain link fence, topped it with razor wire, and established the University of Tennessee Anthropological Research Facility. This was the structural transition the discipline desperately needed. Bass didn't just place bodies in the woods to watch them rot. He treated that hillside like a pristine clinical bench. He began placing subjects in highly specific, controlled scenarios to build a comprehensive, multi-layered environmental audit. They placed samples left completely exposed to the open air under direct, punishing summer sunlight and contrasted that to data with samples hidden under a cool, shaded forest canopy. They locked subjects inside airtight car trunks in mid-July to map the accelerated baking effect on soft tissue. They submerged bodies in natural water tables, buried them in shallow dirt graves, placed them under leaf litter, and even encased them beneath solid slabs of poured concrete. Every single scenario was tracked, logged, and quantified. To understand how this outdoor lab functions, we have to zoom in from broad geography to the microscopic chemical reagents of decay. Taphonomy operates in distinct, measurable phases, creating a biological countdown driven by two primary mechanisms: autolysis and putrefaction. Autolysis, or self-digestion, begins at the microscopic level the moment systemic circulation stops. Deprived of oxygen, intracellular carbon dioxide spikes, causing internal pH to plummet. This acidic shift ruptures lysosomal membranes, releasing aggressive digestive enzymes that begin destroying the surrounding cellular tissue from the inside out. Right on the heels of self-digestion comes putrefaction, where your internal microbiome takes total control. Once autolysis breaches cellular walls, native anaerobic bacteria like Clostridium escape their biological boundaries to feast on fermenting carbohydrates, proteins, and lipids. This anaerobic party produces a toxic gas cascade, including hydrogen sulfide, ammonia, and methane. That accumulates within the sealed cavities of the torso, building internal pressure to create the highly visible stage known as bloat. Dr. Bass's foundational research proved that ambient temperature acts as the primary master control for these biochemical reactions. Because decomposition is entirely enzymatic and bacterial, it strictly follows the laws of chemistry. Extreme summer heat accelerates cellular breakdown and bacterial replication exponentially, while winter cold slows the entire assay down to a baseline crawl. During this process, the molecular breakdown of amino acids produces a shifting cocktail of volatile organic compounds. Among these are specific diamines, most notably putrescine and cadaverine, which create a unique chemical odor profile that shifts systematically over time. Researchers use gas chromatography mass spectrometry to map this exact chemical signature through every stage of exposure. This profile is how handlers train modern cadaver dogs to differentiate between a decomposing human being and buried animal remains. A decaying body also interacts with the earth beneath it. As tissue liquefy during advanced putrefaction, a massive, highly concentrated pulse of organic fluids is forced out into the environment. This releases a spike of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium directly into the topsoil, creating a cadaver decomposition island. This changes the soil chemistry so drastically that it leaves a highly visible burn patch in the local vegetation. You can pull a core sample from that soil and run a laboratory audit to detect the chemical signature of death in human proteins long after physical remains are removed. Furthermore, the ground beneath the remains isn't passive scenery. Soil acidity, moisture levels, and composition act like complex chemical buffers. Investigators must conduct a substrate audit because clay soil seals the moisture in, potentially inducing adipocere formation. Conversely, loose acidic sandy soil accelerates skeletal degradation. A body hidden under a simple plastic tarp versus one placed in a shallow grave creates two entirely separate biological tracks. It may seem morbid, but it is also scientifically vital to track how local fauna leaves its mark on the record. Mice, opossums, vultures, coyotes, these scavengers can all leave distinct marks on the surface of bones. Rodents leave fine parallel grooved gnaw marks as they harvest calcium, while carnivores leave distinct triangular punctures and pitting near the joints. A trained investigator learns to check these marks under a lens to differentiate animal activity from trauma left by a killer trying to dismember a victim. Then, while most people view a decaying body as the absolute end of life, in the outdoor lab, it is a carnival of blowflies, carrion beetles, and microbial life. Insects are our most consistent opportunists, arriving at the scene in predictable, sequential waves. The first responders are members of the Calophoridae family, the common blowfly, which can detect the chemical off-gassing of a body within minutes, often beating police to a scene. The blowfly uses the remains as a nursery, laying thousands of eggs in moist orifices like eyes, nose, and mouth to ensure larval survival. A forensic entomologist can harvest the maggots or puparia directly from the body. By identifying the exact species under a microscope and working backward using local weather data, the analyst calculates the minimum postmortem interval. They aren't guessing time of death. They are tracking the strict biological growth cycle of a living organism. Furthermore, these colonization patterns serve as a major diagnostic tool. If an investigator finds a hyper-concentrated insect colony swarming the hands, chest, or abdomen instead of the facial orifices, it creates an immediate red flag. This tells the investigator that an artificial breach in the skin was present at death, exposing exactly where a wound was located. One of the most important findings to come out of the body farm was degree day math. In a modern court of law, determining a timeline isn't an artistic hunch or a generic estimation. It's a strict mathematical equation that can make or break an alibi. Accumulated degree days is a formula used by forensic scientists to quantify the heat energy available for biological and chemical reactions over a specific time frame. Because insects are cold-blooded, their metabolic rate and development are entirely dependent on ambient environmental temperature. Every insect species has a known base temperature below which growth stops, and a fixed thermal requirement to progress from an egg through its larval stages into an adult fly. An investigator measures the average daily temperature at the scene, subtracts the insect's baseline development threshold, and calculates the heat energy accumulated each day. By stacking these daily units until they match the developmental stage of the insects collected off the victim, the analyst works backward down the calendar to pinpoint the exact day of colonization. It's a mathematical calculation that strips away any subjective argument in a courtroom. Beyond the time of death determinations, we have the contributions to the current status of forensic anthropology. For nearly a century, the absolute gold standard for human skeletal identification was the Robert J. Terry Anatomical Skeleton Collection, permanently housed at the Smithsonian Institution. Curated in the early to mid-20th century by Dr. Robert J. Terry and his successor, Dr. Mildred Trotter, this archive consists of some 1,728 human skeletons. It was a monumental achievement for its time, providing the foundational metrics for height, sex, and ancestry estimation that early forensic pioneers used to build their initial data ledgers. However, from a 2026 laboratory reality standpoint, relying solely on the Terry collection to analyze modern skeletal remains is like trying to run the latest heavy-duty AI software on a 1980s Macintosh operating system. The individuals in the Terry collection live, worked, and died in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Their bones reflect a bygone era of human existence, saturated with the structural signatures of widespread rickets, untreated tuberculosis, severe childhood malnutrition, and the crushing mechanical wear of intense manual labor unmitigated by modern medicine. A modern forensic analyst simply cannot use an outdated database to accurately identify human remains today. Humans have changed drastically over the last century. Our long bones are longer, we are taller, our skull structures have subtly shifted. Furthermore, our modern skeletal profile contains unique 21st century biological markers, reflecting an era of fluoridated water, systemic antibiotics, highly processed nutritional profiles, and widespread orthopedic interventions. In the Bass collection, this structural calibration gap was finally closed. Because of the body donation program established alongside the outdoor laboratory, UT Knoxville now curates the William M. Bass Forensic Anthropology Collection, comprising the skeletal remains of over 1,700 individuals. It is the largest modern human skeletal collection in existence, a living, continuously updating biological ledger of contemporary humanity. When a modern forensic anthropologist receives an unidentified bone found in the woods today, they don't just guess its profile using old textbook charts. They utilize advanced software like FORDISC, which relies directly on the Bass collection to constantly recalibrate its discriminant functions. By comparing unknown skeletal metrics against a dynamic modern baseline rather than a historical sample from the 1800s, the science ensures that the calibration of justice remains completely accurate, precise, and current. However, to truly appreciate the scale of modern forensic taphonomy, you have to realize that the University of Tennessee was just the proof of concept. Forensic science cannot utilize a one-size-fits-all timeline because the environment is always the final editor. When you step back and look through a macro lens, you start to see the entire world as a shifting, dynamic series of localized chemical and biological reactions. A postmortem interval calculated under the temperate oak trees of Knoxville, Tennessee, completely fails if a crime scene is a scorched desert floor in West Texas or a stagnant subtropical swamp in the Florida Everglades. This critical realization that data must be calibrated to geography led to the expansion of an entire national network of regional satellite facilities. Each facility acts as a highly specialized outdoor laboratory, running its own localized assays to build a comprehensive continental environmental audit. There's now an entire system that relies on the foundational control site at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. It is the baseline temperate forest. There, under a humid four-season canopy, the research focus stays locked on rapid blowfly colonization, seasonal woodland decay, and heavy liquefaction. It's an environment where the biological record is methodically and rapidly recycled back into the ecosystem by local subterranean fauna, providing the gold standard metrics for any temperate zone investigation. But when you cross the state line into the intense southern heat and heavy pine canopy humidity of the East Texas piney woods, the entire taphonomic script changes. At Sam Houston State University's facility, researchers run what is essentially a massive scavenger audit. This site is a clinical asset for studying how avian scavengers like black vultures and turkey vultures interact with human remains. The data gathered here prove that a flock of vultures can completely strip a human sample to bare bone in a matter of hours rather than days. For an uncalibrated investigator arriving at a skeletal scene, that hyper-accelerated timeline would be completely baffling without the Texas data to back it up. Move just a few hours west into the arid hill country of San Marcos, and Texas State University operates the largest facility of its kind, a massive 26-acre true dry lab under a punishing direct sun and extreme drought conditions. The internal bacterial engine of putrefaction is frequently scorched and arrested before it can even initiate systemic bloat. Instead of liquefying, the soft tissue quickly dehydrates. The environment turns the outer skin into a tough, leathery parchment that can preserve underlying trauma patterns and knife tracks for years, offering an entirely different preservation metric for desert environments. Taphonomy isn't just about heat indices and humidity ratios, though. It's also about sheer topography. Up in the Blue Ridge Mountains, Western Carolina University utilizes its unique high-altitude terrain to study the friction between gravity and slope. When a body is placed on a steep mountain incline, gravity fundamentally changes how decomposition fluids pool and escape the tissue. This alters the local soil chemistry and insect migration tracks, creating a distinct biological ledger that is vital for mountain search and rescue teams trying to trace an old scent or a hidden recovery site. If you scale the geography even higher, into the high desert of Grand Junction, Colorado, Mesa University runs the network's premier cold weather site. This is the freeze-thaw boundary. In this arid alpine climate, researchers audit how extreme mountain winters freeze and preserve evidence, halting decay entirely for months at a time. The dry freezing air can mummify a sample before native bacteria ever get a chance to mobilize, providing the exact chemical and structural parameters needed to solve deep wilderness cold cases where a body has crossed multiple seasonal shifts. And finally, you hit the aquatic heavy hitter in the University of South Florida in Tampa. This subtropical high moisture facility deals with a punishing 90% humidity level, frequent standing water, and an incredibly high water table. The research here focuses heavily on complete submersion and a massive predatory bioload of insects that thrive in constant swamp-like heat. The insect and microbial activity is accelerated to an absolute extreme, giving investigators the precise comparative data needed for cases involving bodies recovered from bayous, swamps, or humid coastal wetlands. When you look at the entire network as a single interconnected matrix, it becomes the ultimate tool for geographic calibration. It ensures that no matter where an investigation takes place, science has an operational outpost designed to read that specific environment and extract the raw data of truth. How does this massive outdoor reference library actually secure convictions and clear names in a modern court of law? It happens when we take the theoretical data points from the hillside in Knoxville or similar sites and weaponize them against false narratives. Here are three distinct case studies where calibrated taphonomic data completely altered the trajectory of justice. In 1995, a North Carolina man named Alan Gale was arrested, charged, and subsequently sentenced to death for the murder of an elderly man named Alan Ray Jenkins. The state's entire prosecutorial theory was built upon the testimony of two teenage jailhouse informants. These witnesses swore under oath that they had accompanied Gell to the victim's home on April 3rd, 1995, where they witnessed Gell commit the robbery and murder. Because the victim's body wasn't discovered until April 14, 11 days later, and because Gell had a rock-solid, verifiable alibi proving that he was out of state starting on April 4th, The entire case hinged on locking down the timeline specifically to that April 3rd window. During the initial autopsy, investigators had collected a series of blowfly larvae crawling within the victim's remains. Years later, during the appeals process, defense experts took that entomological evidence and subjected it to the strict accumulated degree day mathematical formulas perfected at the body farm. They didn't look at the case through the lens of subjective human memory. They looked at it through the lens of cold-blooded biological growth. The defense experts pulled the exact hourly temperature logs from the nearest weather station covering those 11 days in April. They calculated the thermal energy available to the insects inside that specific house. The math revealed a glaring, undeniable conflict. If the victim had been killed on April 3rd, the blowfly larvae on the body would have transitioned into late-stage pupae or fully emerged adults by April 14. Instead, the collected samples were still small, active third instar larvae. The insect clock proved that the body had not been dead for 11 days. It had exposed to the elements for a maximum of 3 to 4 days. This data completely shattered the state's timeline. The biological ledger proved the victim was actually killed around April 10th or 11th, a time frame during which Alan Gell was demonstrably hundreds of miles away and under continuous surveillance by an entirely separate jurisdiction. He was in jail. The unbribable witness of entomological succession provided an objective, irrefutable alibi that human bias could not overwrite. In 2003, after spending years on death row for a crime he could not have physically committed, Alan Gell was completely exonerated and freed from custody. Our second case outlines how outdoor taphonomy can dismantle forensic countermeasures. Local authorities were called to a remote field where a vehicle was found completely engulfed in flames. Once the fire was suppressed, firefighters discovered a heavily charred, near-skeletal body slumped in the front seat. The defense team and the initial field assessment suggested that this was a tragic, accidental car fire, a closed-loop system where the victim succumbed to smoke inhalation and thermal trauma inside a malfunctioning vehicle. The defense argued that because the fire was so intense, any potential biological evidence of foul play had been completely vaporized, leaving the state with nothing but a tragic accident. However, the prosecution's forensic team brought in a specialized analyst trained in the laboratory protocols of the body farm. During a meticulous microscopic examination of the charred debris recovered from deep within the pelvic and thoracic cavities of the remains, analysts found something that shouldn't exist in a flash fire: insect puparia, commonly known as maggot casings. Crucially, these puparia were heavily charred on the outside but retained their structural uncollapsed shape on the inside. The analyst turned to Case 9123, a specialized research track at the University of Tennessee that specifically audits how insects and bones react to vehicular arson. The data baseline shows that if a living person dies in a fire or if a fresh body is burned immediately after death, there is zero time for blowflies to detect the body, lay eggs, and have those eggs hatch into maggots that feed, mature, and form hard pupal casings. For puparia to be present deep inside the tissue, the body had to have been dead long enough for multiple generations of flies to complete an entire life cycle. Furthermore, the structural integrity of the charred casings proved another critical data point. If the insects had been active and alive when the fire started, the moisture inside the maggots would have boiled, causing the casings to violently explode and collapse under the thermal shock. The fact that they were empty, dry, and structurally intact meant the flies had already completed their cycle and flown away before the matches were ever struck. The science exposed the fire for exactly what it was, a staged forensic countermeasure. The perpetrator had murdered the victim, dumped the body in a field for days, and then returned with an accelerant to torch the vehicle in a desperate bid to erase the timeline. The arson audit turned the defense's vaporized evidence argument into the exact mechanism that secured a homicide conviction. We talk a lot about forensics to solve active crimes, but sometimes anthropology is caused in just to fix the historical record because pop culture decided to go on full-on mythmaker. On February 3rd, 1959, small charter airplane carrying rock and roll icons Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and JP the Big Bopper Richardson crashed into a frozen cornfield in Clear Lake, Iowa, killing everyone on board. For nearly 50 years, a dark conspiracy theory loomed over the tragedy. Rumors persisted that an accidental or intentional gunshot had been fired inside the cabin, incapacitating the pilot and causing the crash. These rumors gained traction because the pilot's handgun was recovered from the debris field, and news reports noted that Richardson's body was found a remarkable 40 feet away from the main wreckage, completely separated from the others. In 2007, Richardson's son made the decision to exhume his father's remains to settle the historical record once and for all. They brought in the one man who had spent decades cataloging exactly what high-velocity kinetic impact does to human bone, Dr. William Bass himself. Dr. Bass conducted a comprehensive macro and radiological audit of the skeletal structures, utilizing the modern trauma metrics he had spent 25 years validating through the Bass skeletal collection. If a bullet had struck Richardson, the bone would exhibit highly specific, localized signatures, namely internal beveling, radiating fracture lines centered around an entry point, and distinct lead blooming under X-ray illumination. Dr. Bass's laboratory audit found absolutely zero evidence of projectile trauma. Instead, what his ledger revealed was a textbook map of massive systemic blunt force deceleration trauma. Every major long bone in Richardson's arms and legs exhibited severe comminuted fractures, meaning the bone had splintered into multiple fragments under immense uniform force. His ribs were fractured symmetrically, and his skull showed craniomaxillofacial fractures that were completely consistent with a human body being ejected from an aircraft traveling at over 100 miles per hour into frozen topsoil. The trauma pattern was uniform, catastrophic, and completely incompatible with a small caliber gunshot wound. Dr. Bass didn't rely on historical hearsay, sensationalized news clippings, or half-century-old rumors. He let the fractures speak for themselves against a modern, verified trauma database. The clinical report concluded that Richardson had died instantly from massive, non-survivable impact trauma, completely dismantling the gunshot conspiracy theory and restoring clean historical truth to one of American music's most enduring tragedies. As we look over the horizon, the field of forensic taphonomy is undergoing a major technological migration, moving steadily out of the dirt and directly into the digital cloud. Modern facilities are utilizing high-resolution, full-body 3D laser scanning, virtual autopsies via advanced CT imagery, and digital bone mapping to construct an immersive, permanent virtual audit of the decomposition process. This shift means that instead of a timeline being trapped on a single hillside in Tennessee, pristine three-dimensional spatial record can be audited by forensic experts globally without ever disrupting the biological integrity of the remains. We are preserving transient environmental data as permanent, unalterable digital code. When we pull our eyes away from the high-density laboratory metrics, the gas chromatography readouts, and the skeletal measurements, we uncover the real moral spine of this entire discipline. It's easy for outsiders to mischaracterize this field as morbid, but when you look at the systemic output, it breaks down into three profoundly humanitarian pillars. The first is the final witness perspective. We need to fundamentally reframe how we view these individuals who rest within these research enclosures. They are not clinical subjects or passive specimens. They are active scientific collaborators. When an unidentified human murder victim is discovered in the wilderness, they have been completely silenced by the environment. The data gathered across our taphonomic network is the exact Rosetta Stone that teaches investigators how to translate that silent language of decay back into a definitive human identity. At its core, this work is about returning a legal name, a history, and a dignity to a John or Jane Doe. The second pillar is the calibration of justice. Think about the sheer volume of cold cases permanently closed, or conversely, the wrongfully convicted individuals who have been exonerated because a taphonomist stood on a witness stand and proved a prosecutor's timeline was biologically impossible. If our reference material is broken or outdated, the scales of justice fail. The outdoor lab ensures that the legal system runs on a foundation of calibrated reality, not speculative guesswork. Lastly, we have the global human rights footprint. The protocols perfected in these localized plots have a massive internal national reach. Taphonomic methodologies developed in the woods of Tennessee are utilized globally to locate mass clandestine graves, document war crimes, and identify victims of genocide. It is a highly specialized local science that leaves a permanent humanitarian footprint, providing answers to families who have lost everything to state-sponsored terror. Let's be completely honest about human nature here. Humans are wonderfully, beautifully weird, and there is a bizarrely profound paradox sitting right at the center of the body donation program. Think about the demographics. These are people who spent their entire lives living completely avoiding the wilderness. People who refused to camp, hated the outdoors, or were absolutely terrified of insects. Yet by their own signature, they intentionally chose to spend their afterlife inside a secure research enclosure in a forest. They willingly submit their physical bodies to the elements and to the blowflies for one simple reason: to help catch a killer they will never meet, protecting a stranger they will never see. It sounds grotesque on the surface to a society that isolates itself from mortality, but from a forensic standpoint, it is the highest form of social cooperation. There's a strange, poetic beauty in taking the one thing everyone is squeamish about, death, and transforming it into an unassailable weapon for justice. When a donor signs those papers, they choose to become the final witness, donating their own passings so that a decade down the line, an investigator can use their biological ledger to speak for those who can no longer can. So today we trace the evolution of a science that stepped out of the shadows of the 19th century resurrection men, survived a massive calibration reality check with the exhumation of Colonel William Shi, and ultimately realized that animal proxies like pigs are simply an incomplete ledger for human justice. We looked at how Dr. William Bass's baseline research at UT Knoxville blossomed into a continental taphonomic network. From the scorched, mummifying high desert of Texas to the hyper-accelerated decay of the Florida swamps, we now know that forensic science cannot utilize a one-size-fits-all timeline because the local environment always holds the final pen. Taphonomy is a rigorous data science, an equation driven by microscopic autolysis, changing soil solutions, shifting volatile organic compounds, and the strict mathematical accuracy of accumulated degree days. But more than the gas chromatography readouts or the skeletal metrics, the ultimate takeaway today is a story of profound human cooperation. It is the poetic reality of the donors, the final witnesses, who willingly give their own passing to the digital cloud and the forest floor so that their biological records can speak for the silenced. They turn the one thing society avoids into an unassailable tool for truth. Because on the bench, in the field, and in the courtroom, knowledge powers justice. So, next week, we're doing something a little bit different. As we end my birthday month, I want to introduce a new topic, an audit of cases currently in the news, and advances being made in forensic science or science in general. As I've stated, this podcast is about learning together and fangirling over the science, so I hope you'll join me. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue learning along with me. If you found today's deep dive into the chemistry of death fascinating, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred provider. Reviews help other science-minded true crime fans find the show, so I encourage you to tell your accomplices, I mean friends, to learn along with us. I'd love to hear your thoughts on these cases or any future topics you'd like to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder, or reach me directly at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. Stay curious, stay scientific, and join us in our next episode.